singing, "Good day, comrade." He presented a cup of tea, wiped the already clean surface of the table, and hobbled out. "Long live our great leader!"
"Well,"
Ba Lut said, when the village had returned,
"where are they? I'm very eager to see them."
The disheveled man looked as if he had been to Moscow and back.
"Well, of course," he began, "they're registered here."
"Yes, yes."
"But this morning, or more accurately, at the present hour..."
"Comrade Wun is a greatly admired lyricist, a book of songs, as the saying goes. We can have no other for our concert. General Chen Yi himself insists."
The man looked up, startled.
"Oh, respects to Chen Yi, a brave general, and a faithful servant to Chairman Mao himself, a 12-barrel hero. Long may he..."
Ba Lut took a gulp of tea and slapped the cup on the table.
"Comrade Wun and his wife must present themselves immediately. I'm ready to press on."
"Brother comrade, life goes in unexpected spirals. That is to say, there are many unexpected places to which a man returns."
"Your poetry confuses me, comrade."
The man blushed.
"Let me begin again. Elder brother, the truth of the matter is, they are not here."
The man shifted uncomfortably.
"Speak freely, please."
The man poured tea and bade him drink. Ba Lut waited. The fan turned faster now, as if trying to take flight.
"We did our utmost to keep order," the man said. "But as a leading light, such as yourself knows, the people cannot move in half-steps. They would only fall down, wouldn't they? To traverse so great a divide, they must leap and sometimes overleap, and it could be that in the case of Comrade Wun, they have, perhaps, overleapt. However, we live in a time in which the revolutionary dream must run its course, don't you agree?"
Ba Lut said nothing. The cake tasted old in his mouth.
"It appears," the man said, "that Comrade Wun and his wife had a hidden cellar on his family's ancestral land."
Ba Lut drank the remaining tea in his cup and looked thoughtfully at the pot.
"That is no crime, comrade."
The man waited and let silence stand in for contradiction.
"Of course," he continued. "The contraband always surfaces. We confiscated everything, books, records, some valuable heirlooms. He had the Book of Songs and the Book of History. He also possessed books from America. I am surprised," he said, allowing a brief pause, "that you did not know."
Ba Lut looked at the wall behind the man. There was no mistaking the sudden change in tone. All that confused poetry, that shiny sweat, suddenly vanishing like a mist.
"I did not know,"
Ba Lut said evenly.
"Hmm."
The man stood up, reached up to a long string, and stopped the fan. It slowed to a halt and left the room confined and utterly still.
"As cadres, we, of course, can only serve the people and follow the party line. We turned him over to the Revolutionary Committee, and they passed judgment. He was found to be a dangerous element."
Ba Lut's throat was dry, but no more tea was offered.
"Re-education through hard labor," the man continued, sitting down again. "This was the conclusion, and he was duly taken away."
"And his wife, Comrade Swirl?"
"Convicted rightist and shameless bourgeois element. The same punishment."
The man seemed to thrive in the heat now. He looked pink and golden.
"This hidden library, may have been built by Comrade Wun's mother during one war or another to hide these rare books from invaders. She died last year, so how can we know? Perhaps you've heard of her father, Old West? A reactionary element, very close to the imperialist regime in his day. Of course, Old West was once a celebrated scholar sent abroad to serve his country, and such hiding places were once common. Well, who am I to judge? We are only a small village. We are still learning the correct line. The man smiled at Balut. How strange this smile was, part pity, part warning. The Revolutionary Committee operates under Chen Yi, does it not? The man said smoothly. I imagine that Chen Yi might have informed you of the sentence that was handed out.
Tell me,
Balut said, ignoring the man's insinuation. How was the library discovered?
Comrade Wooden and his wife were in the fields as usual. Their daughter climbed down into the opening. It was she who discovered it. The melting ice must have dislodged the entrance.
He poured the last of his tea into a potted plant on the floor. Then he replaced the cup soundlessly on the table.
It was warm down there. More comfortable, in fact, than where they were living. One of the villagers was crossing the field, and he saw Comrade Zhu Li disappearing, as if swallowed up by the earth.
The village head studied him openly. Balut stared back, unrepentant. Behind the labored elegance, the cloaked eyes, and the man's soft, sweating nose, his unwavering expression was familiar. The silence between them grew thoughtful. Balut closed his eyes, and then looked at the village head again. He felt as if he had exited the office and then re-entered through a different door.
I knew you at headquarters, back in 46, didn't I?
The man's face lit up with pleasure. Balut continued.
You were recruited for the orchestra. Maybe it was 44, could it be?
He could see these eyes now, that shiny bald head behind an oboe. The orchestra leader had gone to the villages to recruit youngsters, and his friend, Li Delun, had taught them how to play.
These kids have never even seen an instrument in their dreams,
Delun had said. Even the way the new recruits held their oboes and trumpets was humorous, walking with them as if with a brand new girlfriend.
Ah, ah, aha,
Balut said, trying to clear his thoughts.
Wasn't it a memorable time? The man said. Learning to play the oboe in the middle of the Japanese invasion, reforming our thoughts and holding ballroom dances every Saturday night. The great leaders like to waltz. This surprised me.
There is no music ensemble here,
Balut said.
No, not here.
Do you still have your oboe?
Silence. The man hesitated, unsure if a joke was being made at his expense.
Yes,
he admitted.
Old One Two,
Balut said, suddenly remembering the man's name. They had all taken part in the same self-criticism sessions, which in reality were open attacks on one another. This man had been strict, but he had not been a sadist like some of the others.
We named you 1-2 because you could never count inside your head.
The man laughed. The sound was so unexpected, Balut started and knocked over his empty cup. The man quickly righted it.
You're right. The trombonist gave me that name, he said. It stuck.
Balut was so thirsty, even his eyes felt dry. An image came to him of his room and all the past rooms he had known. He tried to see how all the doorways and entrances fit together, but none of the corners would hold still.
"Tell me your requirements," he said finally.
"My friend, you misunderstand me."
"I would like permission to visit them. Are they being detained nearby?"
"Comrade," the man said, "that is not possible."
He blinked rapidly, as if his feelings had been injured.
"They were sentenced to labor in the Northwest. In the meantime, the Revolutionary Committee had no choice but to demolish their hut."
So the letter had not exaggerated, Balut thought. They were gone. 1-2 stood up from the desk.
"You must know how things are. You are justly celebrated, a champion of the land reform campaign, a triumphant musical foot soldier. We hardened ourselves at headquarters, didn't we? We were the first to be reformed through struggle. As Chairman Mao says, true rebellion is not organized or beautiful. Heroes like you built the road. I'm only following the path."
How could such flattering words feel like mockery? The office was terribly clean, terribly bright.
"More tea?"
the man asked.
"No, thank you."
"Is there something else I might assist you with?"
Balut stood, raising himself up to his full height. The village head shifted uncomfortably.
"Thank you, comrade,"
Balut said.
"You've been very helpful. I'm sure we'll have a chance to speak again."
"Now I remember," the man said, though of course he had never forgotten. "The wife of my deputy met your wife on the bus, and though the journey was only a day, they formed a bond together. Since then, she has kept a watchful eye on Julie, delivering her to safety."
Balut felt the walls shifting once again.
"One should be careful of the sun," the man said,
as if talking to himself. He reached out, pulled the string, and the fan started up once more.
"One should learn to practice in the shade."
The cold forced its way in. Even though Swirl had emptied her suitcase and wore every piece of clothing she owned, there was no way to defeat it. Just now at the tap, she had watched, mesmerized, as her hands submerged in water, and she had failed to register any sensation. It was as if the hands belonged to someone else. She had yanked them out, frightened, nonsensically, that the fingers would shatter. Nothing around her was what it seemed. The air, thick blue, appeared like paper. She shared a single long bed with a district leader, a doctor, an economist, a public security officer, a schoolteacher, a tax lawyer, and a translator of Russian literature. She herself was known as the wife. The first week, she had identified them by their sleeping habits, how they tossed, shouted, and snored, how often they got up at night, how violently they squeezed back in, or if they slept as motionless as death. This morning, the district leader, convinced she had committed no crime, was speculating about her release date.
"Perhaps today," she said. "This month, certainly."
"Comrade, don't you see this very idea makes you a perfect candidate for re-education?"
The economist, who had been here the longest, was convinced no one would ever leave.
"I committed myself to the party when I was 11 years old. Without people like me, there would be no revolution."
"Hush! You're the only one who still thinks of yourself as a revolutionary."
The other women tittered, but the district leader was unbothered.
"I don't expect a criminal like you to understand. The party is my family, and I would rather die than betray it."
After roll call, they filed into the canteen. So many feet made a storm in the dust. It colored the air. caked the floors, and was the salt to everything that touched their lips. Swirl and the translator ate side by side. The translator chewed with her eyes, tightly closed, making noises of gratitude as if, in her mind, she was relishing a succulent leg of duck. Yesterday, Swirl had been handed a notice from the Pingpai Revolutionary Committee stating that Zhu Li was now registered to live in Shanghai. The news had taken such a weight from Swirl that she, who never cried, had surprised everyone by weeping continuously. She had no news of Wen, only rumors that in the men's camp not far away, no one survived. The corpses were left in the desert, unburied. Swirl would not allow herself to believe it. Outside, beneath a sky that had turned from blue to paper white, they got in line to rinse their bowls. The color of purity, Swirl thought. The ancients had imagined white as the color of funerals, of fulfillment, loss, and completion, and now the white sky seemed ready to erase the earth. She hoisted up a basket and spade, and joined her group. Try as she might, she couldn't understand how she had walked to the cliff edge and found herself here. At the work site, several kilometers away, they were digging a channel. The soil, dry and easily eroded, fell apart under minimal pressure. She worked without thoughts. By midday, the sand glowed like a coin. Night after night, stories were passed across the long bed. Months ticked by, until at last she knew the intricate histories of all the women she slept beside, and they knew hers. A line of women who, one by one, had fallen through a rip in a dream, and woken here. A lifetime ago, Swirl had gone to the ticketing office in Shanghai, ready to buy passage to Hong Kong, but she had been distracted by a novel, The Book of Records. It embarrassed her now, the way she burned candles so unthinkingly, gazing at words that seemed to hide ideas, or ideas inexpressible in words. How the sentences had carried her forward like a river or a piece of music, and yet how close the truth had seemed back then. She had been 24 years old, and she had fallen in love. Each day the darkness fell fast. Black was the color of the northern sky, and therefore the heavens, the color of the oceans, and everything profound and necessary. And so it must contain the life she was trying to reach. Her hands trembled all the time. On upholding her sentence, the head of the Pingpai Revolutionary Committee had assessed her coldly. He had concluded, "Deep in your heart, you oppose the Communist Party." Swirl had denied the accusation, but if it hadn't been true then, surely it was true now. Maybe her crime had been as simple as the inability to believe. In truth, since the age of 14 and until she met Wen, she had believed in almost nothing. The life of a prisoner is one of endless motion. She was moved here and there like a sack of goods. Dig ditches, mill flour, tend the pigs, grow vegetables, reform your thoughts, love the party, collect firewood, denounce others, wash the grain, sing a song. The district leader, so sure she would be resurrected back to society, eventually committed suicide. The economist, adamant that the universe had forgotten them, was the first to be released. Day followed night, until Swirl suspected the party itself no longer knew her whereabouts. No letters arrived, and no word from Wen. She remembered sitting at the tea house, waiting for installments that would never come. The doctor told them of a camp not far away where a woman, who had been pregnant when she was sentenced, had given birth, and the little boy had become the joy of the women's dormitory. The story seemed impossible. How could a mother and infant survive in these conditions? Swirl dreamed of Big Mother, and for days consoled herself with childhood. In a dream, she sat beside her lost son, her parents, Wen, Zu Li. They talked about everything, and then, when time ran out, they returned her to the dormitory, fitting her back like a book on a shelf. Her one friend was the translator of Russian literature, and Swirl loved her. She would have given her the last fun in her pocket, the last piece of bread. The friend, quite famous, was the premier translator of the works of Dostoevsky. On the long bed, the translator had been the first to volunteer her story.
"It was during the Hundred Flowers campaign. They told us to criticize the party, the university, each other, even the quality of our lunches and the functioning of the toilets."
The translator turned over, and so did all the women, one after another, like waves against the shore.
"So I, the idiot, stepped forward and said that my request for permission to travel to Leningrad had been denied 14 times, and that a scholar of my standing must engage with her contemporaries. While I carried on, everyone else ran for higher ground. What I later wondered,"
the translator said, laying an index finger gently on her own nose,
"was how I could have studied Dostoevsky so keenly and not realized I was digging my own grave."
The word Dostoevsky, made up of 8 different ideograms, made them all murmur in admiration.
"My old mother thinks I've been assigned to a university in Harbin. She'll fall to Heaven's Gate if she learns the truth."
The translator thumped the bed with her hand, as if to chase away a ghost.
"We must not lose hope. Chairman Mao is a good man. He knows our qualities, and he will rescue us."
The translator pressed one hand to her heart, as if to keep from breaking. An echo of agreement rolled from woman to woman.
"How can it be otherwise?"
There came a period of time when there was no food. These were months of desperation. Even labor was halted. The camp director agreed that energy would be better spent seeking wild grasses or roots. Famine was devastating the province. To give a single grain of millet to convicts would surely be a counter-revolutionary crime. Swirl had the sensation of pages fluttering before her eyes. It was the translator fanning her. She had the sensation of being rolled down a hallway. It was the translator massaging her arms and legs. She dreamed she was eating a succulent duck leg. It was the translator who had stolen a handful of beans from the kitchen of the camp director, cooked them illicitly, and fed them to her. She listened as someone read aloud from the book of records. It wasn't real. It was the translator holding her hand. Confused, Swirl asked, "Who will come to rescue us?" The translator said, with a small smile,
"No one. So be it."
At the end of the famine, there were only 3 left on their long bed: the translator, the tax lawyer, and Swirl. They slept curled together for warmth. The rest, the doctor, public security officer, school teacher, and district leader, had gone, as the saying went, into the pure white sky, into the western heavens. In 1963, the tax lawyer was released, and Swirl and the translator were transferred to a camp called Farm 835. For the first time, they were allowed to receive mail. Swirl was greeted with 2 envelopes of letters, from Big Mother and the family, and from Zu Li. Packets so thick they took up half her sleeping mat. She savored one each day, as if each was a bowl of rice. The translator, alone in the world, had received nothing. One day, They were preparing the translator's coat for winter, sewing layers of cotton batting into the lining. The translator was sitting with her eyes closed. She had a washcloth resting on her feet in place of shoes. A voice called out to them. Swirl glanced up to see one of the guards beside a stranger, a visitor from an alien world. The stranger, a city person, wore blue slacks and a blue coat filmed in dust. The longer she looked at him, the more he seemed like a sign on the road, blurred and far away, difficult to read. He was tall and slender, handsome, perhaps in his early 20s.
"Aunt Swirl?"
She stared. The guard looked at her curiously. He said something to the young man, then turned and walked away, leaving the young man by himself.
"You know me, don't you, Aunt Swirl?"
Her voice didn't work. She tried again, but the words came out strangely.
"Little Sparrow."
The translator opened her eyes.
"A handsome gentleman, to be sure. But, Comrade Swirl, this bird is not so little."
He was standing before them now, setting aside the coat and batting. Swirl got to her feet. She had to hold the translator's shoulder for support.
"Sparrow," she said. "How strange it is to see you. This..."
She shook her head to clear it.
"This is my friend, the Lady Dostoevsky."
"A pleasure to know you, comrade."
"Isn't it, though? Well, come near and let us have a look at you."
Swirl wanted to reassure him, but all the words within reach seemed too thin, too airy. The high dome of the air swallowed their voices.
"How did you arrive? There's no transport for miles."
"By train and bus. After Lanzhou, a donkey cart picked me up. For the last 2 days, we saw no one."
The boy, but he was no longer a boy, looked overwhelmed. It was her, Swirl realized suddenly. She must be quite unrecognizable, and her appearance had upset him. She felt ashamed, even though she knew that it had nothing to do with shame, only time and circumstances, and her powerlessness to change them. She was touched that he made light of the considerable journey from Shanghai, 5 full days of travel at least. Sparrow began unpacking cartons of cigarettes, biscuits, rice, dried fish, salt, preserved vegetables, and box after box of soft sorghum candy. The abundance was so unnerving, the translator let out a soft curse. She leaned sideways.
"So this is the nephew, huh? The composer destined to become the Beethoven of the Huangpu River? Are you sure that's what he does?"
Perhaps out of embarrassment or panic, Sparrow tried to surround them with words. He said everyone was well, that Zhu Li was thriving. He said he was writing music, that his Symphony No. 2 was inspired by their journey across China during the war years, the tea houses and blind musicians. He'd been thinking about the quality of sunshine, that is, how daylight wipes away the stars and the planets, making them invisible to human eyes. If one needed the darkness in order to see the heavens, might daylight be a form of blindness? Could it be that sound was also a form of deafness? If so, what was silence? His eyes had filled with tears, perhaps due to the dryness of the high plateau. She and the translator gazed at him, as if at an apparition. To their astonishment, he withdrew a book from his bag, The Rain on Mount Ba, a classic novel.
"Zhu Li asked me to give this to you, her favorite book."
Swirl took it in her hands, confused.
"But how can Zhu Li be reading it already?"
"She's 11 now,"
Sparrow said, as if confused himself. With the rucksack emptied and hanging uselessly in his hand, he looked forlorn. He wanted to keep bringing things out, she thought, as if he could fill the desert with flowers. The translator lit cigarettes for each of them, and for a long time they simply sat in contemplative silence, smoking. Swirl tried to see the sky and the dormitories and the camp office through Sparrow's eyes, but all she could do was glance at him, as if in a dream, and follow the smoke that curled out of his fingers.
"My mother is petitioning to have your conviction overturned," he said. "She's applied for permission to visit you, and should be able to come within the month. Balut says you mustn't go back to Bingpai. You'll live with us in Shanghai. Zhu Li is such a gifted violinist. She never stops practicing. The conservatory will do anything to keep her."
"But, Sparrow..."
"My parents are still looking for Uncle Wen. I feel certain we'll have news of him soon."
"Sparrow," Swirl said, taking his hand for the first time. She steadied her voice. "You must tell Big Mother that, when you found me, my only sadness was missing my family, my husband, my daughter. Nothing else. No suffering. You must thank them for me. You must tell Zhu Li my life is good. The party is re-educating me, and I'll succeed in correcting my mistakes. Make sure she thinks only of her future. She must not be troubled."
"Of course, Aunt."
Sparrow suddenly remembered something in his pocket. He took out a photograph of Zhu Li with her violin and gave it to her. She had not seen her daughter's face in more than 4 years. She stared at the image, as if into an unknown world.
"What is the famous poem?"
the translator said.
"Destined to arrive in a swirl of dust, and to rise inexorably, like mist on a river. Your daughter looks like you, my dear Swirl. The child has your face."
"Why do I weep?" she thought, trembling. "I should be overjoyed. Her daughter had seemed forever lost to her. And yet here she was, so near and close at hand. Perhaps her husband existed like her, still accused of being a traitor and an enemy, and yet their destinies had merged a long time ago." That afternoon at the camp office, Swirl waited in the doorway, sheltered from the scorching sun, with Sparrow. The oil truck arrived. Her nephew climbed up into the back, and, as if it had always been so easy, he left Farm 835. He held firmly to one of the oil drums, gazing back as the distance between them grew, and she knew there was something he wished to say, but couldn't. She tried to imagine his departure, the camp office diminishing in size, and then other buildings that would arrive and also vanish, until Sparrow came to the rail line, the endless trains and faces in the windows. Daylight drained into the ground. She knew that one day soon, without warning, the conviction against her would be overturned. Like thousands of other surviving counter-revolutionaries, she would be informed, after years of prison labor, that she had never been a criminal. Would she weep? Would she feel joy? She should feel grateful for the chance to return to life. Yet, even as Swirl imagined Shanghai, she feared that only the wide open desert and the sky seemed to know her, that it would sharpen and forever expand.
Chapter 5.
All that afternoon, after Ai Ming and Ma drove away, I sat at the window reading Ma's copy of David Copperfield. Again and again, I returned to the opening lines. "Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show." Around 7 at night, Ma finally came home. I watched her walk across the inner courtyard and ascend the stairs, moving slowly, as if the stairs grew invisibly steeper. Her green coat, delicate as a summer leaf, was so familiar to me. She'd had it since before I was born. I watched it rise through the stairwell as if against the flow of time. Seeing me through the glass, she smiled and began to move faster. She was carrying a parcel in her hands, a small white bakery box. I ran to the door and opened it, pulling Ma inside. I had prepared a meal of rice, cucumbers, and hard-boiled eggs. As we ate, Ma filled the silence by describing in detail how the day had unfolded. The border guard, yawning, had waved them through. On the outskirts of Seattle, they'd run into the morning traffic. They'd stopped for hamburgers. I Ming had bought my favorite sponge cake and sent it home with Ma in the white bakery box. Ma had waited until I Ming boarded the Greyhound. She'd watched the bus pull away and disappear. After dinner, Ma telephoned Shanghai, speaking for over an hour with I Ming's mother. I sat beside her on the sofa, near enough that her voice covered me. In bed that night, I concentrated with all my strength, hoping I could hear my father's voice if only I listened hard enough. Light and shadow slid across the ceiling, now here, now gone, and as I thought about the reasons Ba had left this world, sadness overwhelmed me. Yet the wind sounded against the windows, and in the next room, Ma still breathed and changed and dreamed. I wanted to go to her. I wanted to find a way to protect her. I Ming had left me a letter which I picked up again. We told each other secretly in the quiet midnight world that we wished to fly in heaven, two birds joined wingtip to wingtip, and to grow together on the earth two branches of one tree. Earth endures, heaven endures, even though both shall end. I Ming was the link between us, my father and hers, my mother and me. Until we knew she was safe, how could we possibly let her go? At that time, I thought I never would. In the fall of 1965, I told the windows, the room, the photograph of my father on the desk, on the night before Sparrow's 24th birthday, a young man, wearing an overcoat far too big for his skinny body, arrived in the night.
The household. Balut, Big Mother, and the two boys, Zuli and Swirl, newly released within days of her friend the translator, was fast asleep. But Sparrow was still writing. Outside, a shadow appeared in the laneway. As Sparrow worked on his symphony number 3, he could hear the scratching of their steps back and forth, around and back. The noise crept into his music, a low bassoon interfering with the bass line, now here, now gone. Irritated, Sparrow set down his pencil. He picked up the lamp, descended the stairs, and exited into the courtyard. Listening. No sound at all. He flung open the back gate. The stranger cried out, making them both fall sideways. Embarrassed, Sparrow shook the lamp. "Speak, comrade," he said, as gruffly as he could. "How can I assist you?" At first, only the wind replied, and then the stranger said, his voice no louder than a sigh,
"I'm looking for young Sparrow."
He was very slight, very short, and surely no one to be afraid of. But still the lamp in Sparrow's hand trembled. "Young Sparrow, what do you want with him?" In the stranger's hand, a crumpled envelope appeared. Even in the low light, Sparrow knew the handwriting immediately. It was the very same calligraphy he had gazed at ever since he was a teenager, square, yet full of ardor, telling the story of Da Wei and May 4th. The stranger shivered miserably and yanked his hand back. He was nervous, but not in the smug, twitchy way of a spy or a jailer. Rather, the young man seemed horrified by the width of the alleyway.
"I am he. That is, I'm Sparrow. What do you need, comrade?"
The stranger shook his head.
"Is that a letter for me?"
"I have what you would call news."
"Quickly, come inside."
The stranger shook his head. Sparrow had to prevent himself from dragging him bodily into the house.
"Have you eaten yet?
Come, no one will harm you." The young man glanced past him. The shadows were not kind to him. Everything about him was meager and crushed.
"I will not come in,"
he said softly, as if counseling himself.
"No, no, I will not. Absolutely, definitely not."
Sparrow reached into his pocket. Last night, an official in the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection had paid him 20 yuan for private lessons. The official wanted to learn Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, and the large bills were still on him.
"Comrade, if you cannot stay and join me for a meal, please accept this small, inconsequential gift."
He had intended to pull out just one bill, but all four came out. The young man blinked, stunned. Sparrow hesitated. Then, firmly, as a father might, he took the letter from the stranger's hands and put the money there instead. Now that it was leaving him, Sparrow felt a pang of confusion and remorse. He did not have another fun in his pocket. Still, he held the young man's gaze.
"Accept the money or come inside."
The stranger opened his hand and stared at the miraculous bills.
"I would not take anything from the family of Brother Wen," he whispered. "But my circumstances, well, it's obvious, isn't it?"
He looked at Sparrow directly, and it was clear that the stranger was no more than 11 or 12 years old, a child. And then the boy, his destitution and Sparrow's money, vanished down the laneway. Except for the envelope in Sparrow's hands, it was as if the child had never been. He shut the door and retraced his steps through the inner courtyard. Upstairs from the balcony, he looked out in the direction the boy had run. Dawn had begun to crease the sky, and already the ration lines in Beijing Road was forming, growing longer by the moment. But the child was long gone. The envelope was addressed not to his parents, not to Aunt Swirl or Du Li, but to young Sparrow. He crouched down with the lamp, opened the envelope, slid out the single sheet of paper, and began to read. At dawn, Du Li came out onto the balcony. She called down to Mrs. Ma, who was waiting her turn at the water spigot, wished her good morning, grinned at Sparrow, took his empty teacup away, and returned with it full and steaming. She sat on a broken chair and said,
"Love letter?"
He grunted.
"Dear cousin," she whispered, "happy birthday. May this be the year your thrilling Symphony No. 3 is performed in the concert hall before Chairman Mao himself and our devoted Premier Zhou Enlai, before President He Yuting, and all the grand musicians of the Shanghai Conservatory. May the bouquets at your feet be fragrant and plentiful, and may the soloist of your next piano concerto be a certain elegant boy from Changsha."
"Zhu Li, if you don't hurry, that boy from Changsha will have reserved the best practice room. You'll have to play your violin in the street."
"You're right. Jiang Kai practices more than anyone in the conservatory, except me. But you know," she said, her voice dropping even lower, "the piano in room 103 is ancient, and all the pianists avoid it. for a violinist. There's so much space, it's practically a villa.
She shoved him on the knee.
But really, who is the letter from?
He had turned the envelope over before she recognized her father's handwriting. Premier Zhou Enlai, inviting me to perform at his grand reception where...
The envelope is too plain.
Herr Bach, asking me to...
The envelope is too new.
The neighborhood grandma, asking me why I compose for the degenerate piano rather than the glorious guqin. She nodded.
I see, cousin, she said after a moment. This morning, I found the bag of dried peas that went missing. They were in the sleeve of my mother's coat.
What did you do?
I left them there. She thinks she's such a skillful thief.
She's an excellent thief. Only there's nowhere to hide anything.
The other day, Zhu Li continued, I tried to throw out a sock that had 8 holes in it, but Ma fished it out of the garbage, washed it, mended it, and put it back in my drawer. It's like wearing a fishing net. I've been mending it for the last 3 years. She goes through the trash looking for things. She actually... Last night, she wrapped the quilt twice around herself, even though it was boiling hot. And then she asked me to sleep very close and keep the draft away. I tried to do what she wanted, but there was no draft. Still, she shook and shivered.
His cousin was a joyful and free creature. She seemed to have no relation to any of them. Aunt Swirl went to the end of the world and came back. Give her time.
Speaking of time, she leaped up, grabbing her violin case. I'll come to your office at noon. Let me treat you to a birthday lunch.
Sparrow slipped the envelope away so that he was nearly sitting on it. Cousin, about the Ravel, your technique is excellent, of course, but yesterday the phrasing sounded pinched to me, especially the pizzicato. It's a matter of finding the simple in the complex rather than the complex in the complex. Do you understand what I mean? Work on the bowing today, won't you?
My serious Sparrow, what would I do without you? Come to room 103 at lunchtime, and I'll make Ravel himself proud.
Alone once more, Sparrow picked up the envelope again. It was true. There was nowhere to hide anything in this house, or even this neighborhood, not even a bag of peas or a guilty thought. He reread Wen the Dreamer's letter. Then he took the box of matches from the window ledge, held the letter over the cigarette tin, and set it alight. Wen's handwriting became distorted and round, long and thin, until every sentence was the same, nothing but residue. But Sparrow remembered every word, as if the brief letter was a poem or Bach partita. He could stand up and deliver it now, word for word, note for note. All morning, the words floated through Sparrow's thoughts and would not leave him. Even when Flying Bear dropped his breakfast on the floor and Tha Shan walked barefoot into porcelain shards, the letter continued even as Sparrow washed blood, pottery, and breakfast out of Tha Shan's foot.
Should we go to the clinic? Probably I need stitches.
I don't think so. Antiseptic should do.
Of course.
His voice a disappointed trombone. Meanwhile, Swirl cleaned the floor. Ba Lut dished out another bowl of food. His mother yelled at everyone, and Flying Bear pretended to spear his brother in the back. The letter sat in his mind and brought unexpected tears to Sparrow's eyes. Tha Shan leaned forward, wiped the tears away with his delicate fingers, and said nothing. My dear friend, I trust this letter finds you well, and that you remember me, your dreaming friend, who treasures you like his own son. Today I am neither in the east nor the west. One day I will tell you all the vagaries, cliffhangers, and digressions of the story. But in short, I escaped from H camp and have gone into hiding. I cannot describe conditions to you, little bird. The camp was the very end of the earth. I am no counter-revolutionary, and neither were those exiled with me. In my heart, I believe that it is this age and our leaders who one day will have to account for their crimes. For the last month, I have been searching for a safe house. Last week, fate brought me to Shanghai, and I saw my family. They did not see me, and I did not dare make myself known. The authorities closed in, and I left the city headed for Ji province. Little bird, please do all you can to prevent my family from searching for me. I must close this letter. A book could not hold all I wish to say. Your friend, Comrade Bach. P.S. I have found a further chapter of our book of records. It came into my hands in the most unlikely of places after my transfer from J. P.P.S. If ever the chance presents itself, seek out Comrade Glass Eye in the village of Katz, and do present a copy of the Book of Records to him. He was my companion at J, and his preferred composer is Schoenberg. Tell him you are well acquainted with his childhood friends, the adventurer Tha Wei and the fearless May 4th. 3 days passed before officers from the Public Security Bureau showed up at the door. Like the destitute stranger, the officers came early in the morning, before breakfast was even on the table. Unlike him, they banged on the laneway gate and bullied their way in. They said that the counter-revolutionary criminal rightist political pollutant, and here they had to pause and search through their papers, Comrade Wun, had escaped, critically injuring 2 army officers. They accused Ba Lut of harboring an enemy of the state. Ba Lut listened calmly, but then the 2 officers announced that Swirl and Zhu Li must come immediately for questioning. He leaped forward, flinging down the draft of Sparrow's Symphony No. 3 that happened to be in his hands.
"How dare you shame me in my own house!" he shouted. He began rampaging through the rooms. "Come over here! Is Comrade Wun under the bed? Is he in the closet? Did we use his corpse to fuel the stove? Check the garbage pail, shithouse, and laundry bag!"
He hurled objects across the room as the security officers, pale and unconditioned, knocked each other down in their haste to escape the careening objects of Ba Lut. Sparrow's father was taller than ever, but only half as round, and therefore twice as intimidating.
"Comrade Wun has the aggression of a falling leaf. How did he injure 2 officers? The way a drop of rain injures the pavement? Who's selling potatoes here?"
"Uncle,"
Zhu Li said. "Have you lost your mind?" Big Mother Knife said calmly.
"I've had enough," Ba Lut shouted. "You've wrongly imprisoned his wife. That's right. Look at you quivering like a bag of fresh tofu. Check the records yourselves. She's been resurrected. She's working for the party now, and she's probably ranked higher than you are. You little shits have stained our revolution. And one day, I'm going to haul you before Chen Yi himself and have him whip your balls. Donkeys, do you have any clue who I am?"
Mrs. Ma was summoned, and she sternly informed the officers that she was ahead of the residential committee, and there were absolutely no escaped rightists in her jurisdiction. The very thought, she murmured, was appalling. Everyone here had their papers and household registration in order. They could be sure of that. She tossed her sleek head and offered to escort the officers outside. Beside the door, Sparrow said nothing. The pages of his symphony flung aside by Ba Lut had shoe prints on them. He went to gather them up. Only when the officers were gone did Swirl turn to Big Mother.
"Did they say that one escaped?"
Yes, she said. Her better eye moistened, and she turned away to gauge the destruction that had befallen her house.
But how?
Swirl said, sitting down.
Where could he go?
Balut blustered back into the room, yelling.
Fuck! 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 What have I done?
Sparrow hustled his younger brothers into the kitchen, distracting them with little sugar pyramids and a quick game of watching the tiger. And then he went to the balcony and peered into the can that held the ashes of Wen the Dreamer's letter. There were a dozen ends of cigarettes, a thick wad of tobacco, but not a trace of the page, the writing, or the words. Sparrow looked over the railing. In the laneway, the two officers were deep in agitated conversation. Mrs. Ma was firmly shaking her head. Wastewater from the gutter circled their feet. The letter had disappeared for good, Sparrow thought. It had dissolved into the air itself, escaped to where no officer, spy, or committee chairman could ever retrieve it. At the first opportunity, when no one else was around, he would tell Aunt Swirl that Wen the Dreamer had written. Sparrow left with Zhu Li, his cousin clutching her violin case in both arms, walking with one foot narrowly in front of the other, as if she regretted every inch of space she inhabited. Against the gray-blue wave of oncoming pedestrians, Sparrow wanted to clear a path for her, and so he walked with his chest out and his slender arms swinging, deluding himself that he was a tank and not a paper boat. But nobody, not even school children, moved aside for him. Bicycles whizzed so close their handlebars clipped his elbows. How unlike Balut he was. Given his father's heft, Sparrow felt soft, flimsy, and inessential. The tram arrived. Zhu Li turned and smiled distractedly back at him before the rippling blue of her dress disappeared among the other passengers. They did not meet up again until the gates of the conservatory, where she called down to him from above. Zhu Li was balanced gracefully on a concrete ledge, one hand hooked around the iron fence, the rest of her body tipped to the side. Her hair, gathered in a long braid, sat on her shoulder, and the ends seemed alive in the breeze. Inside the gates, the pianist, Yin Chai, the brightest star of the conservatory, and admittedly appealing in army-style shirt and trousers, was sitting on a bench. He had returned from Moscow after taking second place in the Tchaikovsky competition, and everywhere he went, or so it seemed to Sparrow, a flood of stage lights followed him.
"What do you think, cousin?"
Zhu Li said, making a soft landing beside him. The chatter of the students drummed at him like a headache. He smiled to hide his envy and fell back on a cliché.
"Can the sparrow and swallow know the will of the great swan? Yin Chai is a national treasure."
"I prefer your compositions to his melodrama."
"Do you?"
Sparrow said, unable to believe it. Yet, when his cousin played his work, it was as if she sifted the dust away, lost the notes, and found the music. He told Zhu Li he would come find her in room 103, her preferred practice room, and then dodged the crowd and climbed the imposing staircase. On the ground floor, all 500 of the conservatory's pianos seemed to be singing and feuding together. He skirted room 204 with its gongs and cymbals, 313 with its many-stringed zithers, and the violin-making workshops on 320. On the fourth floor, he glanced past an open door and saw the president of the conservatory, He Luting, deep in conversation with a cadre Sparrow didn't recognize.
"That's your decision,"
He Luting was saying.
"But exactly what constitutes a crime these days?"
President He was famously blunt. Occasionally he invited Sparrow to his home to drink lemonade, listen to records, and read over his compositions.